Hello and welcome to Volume 46, Number 1 of Grapevine, your weekly local news magazine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Saturday the 3rd of January 2026. I'm Graham, your presenter, joined this week by newsreaders Alison and Andrew. Firstly, of course, I must ask you to accept the wish from all your friends at Grapevine that you have a happy and healthy new year. And in the news this week, as we start our 46th year of production, I can tell you that, happily, nothing too serious has happened locally during the festive season. But we have the lowdown on the local recipient of a New Year's honour. The release of a couple of wedge seals also feature, and yes, we may see some snow by the time you're listening to this. We are, once again, online only with this edition, although we will tack it on next week's recording to our postal listeners. I can reveal, however, that we have some really interesting items for you. Some in the news and some special items in Grapevine Extra. So on with the show with Alison and Andrew.
Hello everybody and welcome to Grapevine on the 2nd of January 2026. Happy New Year to you all. Andrew here with you and joined again by Alison.
Hello everyone.
And we're going to start on this bright and sunny day with some news about the Broadland flood defences. Nearly a third of critical flood defences in the Broads area are failing, new figures have revealed, with more than 300 also in disrepair across the county. An investigation has shone a light on the number of flood defences falling below the required standard, which could leave homes and businesses at risk. About 11% of the 3,000 defences across Norfolk are in a declining condition. Of these, 180 are considered high consequence, which means if they fail, it could have serious implications for the area they are meant to be protecting. The statistics speak to a growing concern that more needs to be done to maintain flood defences to ensure people and property are kept safe. A flood defence is defined as any asset that provides protection from rivers, sea or standing water. Traditional flood defences, such as flood walls and embankments, confine water to river channels, preventing it spilling out in particularly vulnerable areas such as towns and cities. Defences are defined as high consequence if they protect multiple homes and businesses. Nationally, about 8.6% of all flood defences are below their target condition. But at a local level, there are huge disparities. In Norfolk, the Broadland area has the highest percentage of high consequence defences at risk, 27% out of the 15 barriers. Now in Great Yarmouth, that figure stands at 5% of the 553 high consequence defences, and 6% of the 81 defences in Norwich are below par, but just 2% of the 64 defences in South Norfolk are in disrepair. Some of the flood defences are managed by the Environment Agency, but others are owned by third parties or local authorities. An Environment Agency spokesman said, "Protecting communities in England from the devastating impact of flooding is a top priority, which is more important than ever as climate change brings more extreme weather." The spokesman went on to say, "Each year we complete up to 165,000 inspections of flood assets across the country and have recently redirected £108 million into repairs and maintenance. This will help to ensure the strongest protection for nearby communities. If the performance of an asset is reduced, then immediate action is taken to ensure that flood risk continues to be effectively managed until the asset is fully repaired or replaced. While high-consequent assets may be below standard, the Environment Authority says they will still work during flood events. Flooding, as we know, is becoming a growing problem nationally, and the condition of the UK's defences has been under scrutiny for all of the past year. Ministers have promised more investment in flood defences to meet the growing risks of major rainfall events."
Speculation that a fresh effort will be made to merge Norfolk and Suffolk police forces has prompted an MP to warn such a move could be disastrous for rural parts of the county. A government policing white paper due in the new year is reportedly set to propose a rationalisation of England and Wales's 43 police forces. With some suggestions, ministers want to create a dozen regional mega forces. But North Norfolk MP Stephen Aquarone said he would oppose such a move, which he claimed would dilute local patrolling, community knowledge and crime prevention. The Liberal Democrat said he feared reduced response times would trigger an increase in rural crime. He said cost-cutting should never come at the expense of actually tackling and solving crime. Rural areas need local officers, fast response times and peace of mind, not a bigger, more distant police force that doesn't prioritise local issues. That's why I'm opposing government plans to merge Norfolk and Suffolk police forces. Tim Passmore, Suffolk Police and Crime Commissioner, last week warned that if several forces were combined, then remote rural areas in Suffolk would actually lose out. The Home Office has not commented on the speculation, but the Financial Times quoted a policing consultant involved in merger discussions as saying it was a no-brainer that Norfolk and Suffolk should combine. The government has already announced that police and crime commissioners, including those for Norfolk and Suffolk, are to be axed. Norfolk and Suffolk's mayor will be taking on their powers when they are elected, although the government intends to delay the inaugural election from this year to 2028. Norfolk and Suffolk Police have been collaborating since 2010 and have a number of joint units and departments, including in major investigations, protective services and IT. A previous attempt to merge Norfolk, Suffolk and Cambridgeshire Police was made in the 2000s when former Norwich South MP Charles Clark was Home Secretary, but it was abandoned.
Now, I'm sure we've all done a lot of shopping in the last month and possibly are still doing so. So here's a story about an iconic local retailer. It became known as the world's largest village store through its memorable advertising campaigns and catchy radio jingles. And after 130 years, Roy's of Wroxham continues to not only survive, but thrive in the competitive modern-day retail arena. Roy's is bucking the trend among high street retailers, reporting a year-on-year rise in sales across its stores. We're winning more business through our garden centres, which are up 7% this year, said Director Paul Roy, grandson of the company founder Alfred Roy. Our supermarket is up 5%, and our standout store is Roy's Toys, which is up 12%. They put their upturn in sales down to a result of lowering their prices. And this year, the retailer was able to reduce the prices of more than 1,000 products by negotiating with its 100 local suppliers. Mr. Roy said, "As we're relatively small, we can deploy our asymmetric advantage and be more agile working with our suppliers to deliver what customers want from us." He joined the company in 1997, having previously worked for Tesco, before later becoming a director. "We stay nimble and agile," he added. "We're not wedded to any dogma. The growth of our sales means more money is kept in the local economy, supporting local wages, suppliers and services, and stimulating future economic activity in the region. Looking after your neighbours has always been good business, and it's never more appropriate than at this time of year." Established in 1895 by brothers Alfred and Arnold Roy, the family-owned retailer now operates 14 sites across East Anglia, with a turnover of more than £55 million a year. Alongside its flagship department store and other locations in Hoverton, Roy's has outlets in Beaufort and Magdalen Street in Norwich, and in Dereham and North Walsham, Thetford, as well as Beccles and Sudbury. But while Roy's has enjoyed a surge in sales over the past 12 months, high street retailers continue to grapple with rising costs and competition from online retailers. The UK lost almost 13,500 shops last year, a closure rate of 37 a day, according to the Centre for Retail Research. And that number of closures was up by 28% on 2023 in what was a brutal year for the high street. Experts are now warning 1,000 more shops will be forced to close in the new year due to increasing wages and business rates announced in last month's budget, with hundreds of thousands of jobs at risk across the country. Roy's employs more than 640 people across its stores, but like all large employers, its wage bill went up significantly this year after increases to the minimum wage and national insurance contributions were announced in the budget. These, of course, come into effect in April. In the Chancellor's latest budget, Rachel Reeves revealed that the minimum wage will rise again next April. Paul Roy said it's been tough for everyone. The rise in the national living wage and minimum wage is forced on us and means we'll end up paying out a lot more money. Pricing pressures are bubbling up in terms of cost, which we need to manage, and I can't see that changing in the foreseeable future. So we're investing in upskilling our staff and trying to redeploy people in higher skilled jobs. It means we can be more productive as a business. I think, ultimately, it comes down to passing the baton on. We've had some fantastic people work for us at Roy's, and we've had a real consistent approach to education and training. And that's why we believe in investing in our staff.
And continuing on that story, a little bit more detail, the history behind Roy's. Roy's began in 1895 when brothers Alfred and Arnold Roy took, together with their sister Catherine, known as Katie, took over a vacant village store in Coltishall. Alfred became the village sub-postmaster while Arnold ran the shop. 4 years later, the family opened a store on land in Hoveton, near Wroxham train station, where delivered goods were addressed to Roy Brothers, Wroxham Station, giving rise to the Roys of Wroxham identity. The original Coltishall store was expanded in 1927, doubling in size with the addition of new departments like men's and women's outfitting and a larger grocery section. In 1931, in May, Roy's Wroxham Limited was formally incorporated, with the company headquarters based in Wroxham. As the Broads holidays grew in popularity, Roy's entered a competition in the early 1930s and earned the title of the world's largest village store. Arnold Roy often joked he was bringing Harrods to Wroxham. Arnold Roy appeared on the BBC programme In Town Tonight, introduced as the man behind the world's largest village store, claiming you could buy anything from a pin to an elephant. After Alfred died in 1951 and Arnold in 1953, ownership passed to Alfred's children, Fred, Peter, Paul and Elizabeth Roy. Fred became chairman and managing director. Peter took over the bakery and Paul managed Coltishall stalls before emigrating to Canada. In 1960, Fred undertook a world tour, studying retail innovations like out-of-town shopping centres. 6 years later, a large modern Roy's store opened in Hoveton, with parking for 100 cars. Roy's joined Associated Department Stores, later AIS, in 1970, improving its purchasing power and competitiveness. In 1995, a catastrophic fire destroyed part of the Wroxham Department Store, which was fully rebuilt and reopened the following year, continuing to serve as its flagship store. In the early 2010s, Roy's bought the Broadland Motor Company petrol station near Wroxham and opened a new store in Beccles, broadening its presence beyond Norfolk. Earlier this year, Roy's went viral online as visitors shared their humorous reactions to the number of Roy's branded shops in Hoveton and Wroxham, asking, "Who's Roy?"
Indeed, that's true. I think you can wander around Hoveton and Wroxham, and you can hear the holidaymakers going, "Who is this Roy chap? Who is this Roy chap?"
Yes.
He's got, and also they've just produced a range of T-shirts with some iconic with their sign on, and one of a sponsored car they used to do, and they're quite a bit of a niche thing for people to have now. So have to hand it to them, don't you?
Yes, they've got initiative.
Middleton Road in Goulston will only allow one-way traffic as it undergoes a period of improvement works. Traffic will only be allowed to travel northbound from January the 17th to February the 18th. This is to allow lane closures for a number of walking and cycling improvements such as cycle lanes, zebra crossing and raised junction tables. Traffic can then travel southbound only from February the 18th until March the 31st, and the work's expected to last for 10 weeks. Signed diversion routes will be in place for the duration of the lane closures and access to properties will be maintained throughout. The public will need to follow the direction of a member of staff on site for safe access to their property.
Eye-opening statistics have revealed that more than 90% of people killed on Norfolk's highways last year died on rural roads, prompting calls for better safety measures. New figures show 37 people were killed on the county's rural roads in 2024, compared with just 4 on urban roads. The previous year there were 29 fatalities on rural roads, with 10 on the county's urban highways. Over the past decade, the pattern has been equally stark, with rural deaths far exceeding those in built-up areas. From 2015 to the end of 2024, Norfolk recorded 297 deaths on rural roads against 44 on urban routes. The figures form part of NFU Mutual's wider analysis of UK road safety, which revealed that 1,350 people have died on rural roads in the east of England in the past 10 years. Across Britain, rural road deaths totaled 9,887 over the same period. Despite years of national road safety improvements, the insurer warns progress on reducing countryside fatalities has stalled, and Norfolk's figures show the risks remain both persistent and severe. Norfolk's rural roads continue to claim lives at a sharply disproportionate rate, prompting renewed calls for an overhaul of how drivers are taught. NFU Mutual is calling for the government to ensure new motorists gain meaningful experience on rural roads, where hazards range from blind bends and narrow verges to unexpectedly slow-moving farm vehicles. The insurer also wants to see the introduction of a rural road safety awareness course for drivers who offend on countryside routes, mirroring the urban-focused speed awareness initiatives already used across the UK. Nick Turner, Chief Executive of NFU Mutual, said the national figures should shock and worry anyone who uses rural routes. He added, in the 10 years to the end of 2024, 10,000 lives were lost on Britain's rural roads. To put that into perspective, that's almost 3 loved ones killed each day over the last decade. I spend my days contemplating how we can reduce risk, protect lives and livelihoods in rural areas. These figures shock and worry me, as they should anyone who lives, works in or visits our countryside. And I'm calling on the government to ensure that the new National Road Safety Strategy addresses this avoidable loss of life in our countryside. It's clear that something needs to change. After years of declining fatalities on rural roads, progress has stalled since around 2012. It's not acceptable that Britain continues to lose around 1,000 people each year to rural road fatalities, and more must be done to prevent this needless loss of life. The report also highlights the heightened dangers faced by vulnerable road users. Across Britain in 2024, 115 pedestrians, 42 cyclists and 253 motorcyclists were killed on rural roads, despite many travelling far fewer miles than motorists. While Norfolk's figures stand out within the east of England, NFU Mutual's analysis shows the trend is repeated across almost every region of Britain, with rural roads consistently producing more fatalities than urban ones. With the government preparing its first major road safety strategy in a decade, campaigners hope Norfolk's figures will reinforce the need for targeted interventions to address countryside dangers.
Plans for new homes in a Norfolk village are being recommended for approval, despite a string of objections. A decision over proposals for 3 new homes off Damgate Lane in Acol will be made by members of Broadland District Council's Planning Committee next week. And officers are recommending that councillors agree to grant applicant James Short permission for the single-storey houses, even though they go against council policy. The homes are earmarked for farmland, which is outside the council's defined limits for new housing in Acol. That, along with concerns over flood risk and the loss of a hedge, are among reasons why Acol Parish Council and 10 other people have objected to the scheme. But council officers say the scheme should be given the green light, partly because the authority is not able to demonstrate a 5-year land supply of housing. Councils need to be able to demonstrate that they have land for at least 5 years' worth of housing. If they cannot, then it can make it harder for them to turn down schemes with the presumption that developers putting forward sustainable housing will be given permission. Broadland District Council can only demonstrate that it has 4.85 years' worth, and officers say the 3 Acol homes would contribute to the 5-year target. In their documents, which will come before councillors, officers acknowledge the site was outside the defined boundary for redevelopment, albeit with four new homes having been recently built next to the site. They said, quote, small amount of harm would be caused to the landscape because of the development of a greenfield site. But, they said, in the context of not being able to demonstrate a five-year housing land supply, councillors should grant permission. They said any harm was outweighed by the small economic benefits from construction jobs and spending on local services and the social benefit of three new homes at a sustainable site. Councillors will make a decision when they meet in the Horizon Centre at Broadland Business Park on Wednesday, January the 7th.
A scaffolder had been experiencing serious mental health difficulties in the months before his death, a court has heard. Terry Salmon, aged 48, of White Drive in Caister, near Great Yarmouth, died at his home last June after he was found unresponsive by his father. An inquest into his death at Norfolk Coroner's Court heard he had experienced difficulties earlier in his life, including problems with alcohol and illicit drugs. He later worked as a scaffolder and enjoyed fishing and spending time in nature. Following the death of his grandmother in November 24, his mental health began to deteriorate. He reported that he was seeing and hearing things others could not. He also developed paranoid beliefs that people were trying to get him. His anxiety increased and he began sleeping and eating poorly. His GP, who took significant care in trying to help him, thought he may have been experiencing psychosis. A referral was made to the early intervention psychosis team, but Mr. Salmon died before being seen. On June the 10th, he was found hanging upstairs in his home. Despite his parents' attempt to help him, he died at the scene. Area coroner Yvonne Blake said in this case, Terry was ill. It was thought that he had psychosis. She recorded a short narrative conclusion, which confirmed Mr. Salmon took his own life, but he had recently been diagnosed with possible psychosis. Mr. Salmon's mother, Pauline Wilson, told the inquest, "It is with a massive heavy heart that I tell you that Terry took his own life by hanging." She added that the death of his grandmother had affected him a lot.
Scammers have been defrauding online sellers in Norfolk out of hundreds of pounds. In the space of just a week, three incidents occurred in Great Yarmouth and Stalham that involved people selling items on Facebook Marketplace and being paid in fake notes. One instance in Great Yarmouth saw a seller who had listed a PlayStation on Facebook Marketplace given £300 in fake notes for the games console. Fake £20 notes were used in Salem to buy a tow truck for £750 and a mobile phone listed on Gumtree for £430. Police have launched an investigation into the incidents and have issued a warning in the meantime. Sellers have been advised to check notes carefully, look for holograms, raised print and watermarks, or use secure online payments.
Time. Find out my memories. in my vodka and lime. I look around, leaves are brown now, and the sky is a hazy shade of winter. Look around, leaves are brown, there's a patch of snow on the ground. Look around, leaves are brown, there's a patch of snow on the ground. Look around, leaves are brown, there's a patch of snow.
Well, one of my favourite Simon and Garfunkel songs there, A Hazy Shade of Winter. And as if by magic, as I record this on Saturday morning, it's started to snow. Someone get a shovel quickly. OK, we've got Grapevine Extra in just a while, after we get you fully up to date with the rest of this week's local news.
In the middle of winter, it's quite nice to think ahead to the summer, and here's something about the Broads Rangers. Getting paid to pass your days on a boat exploring the Norfolk Broads would, on the face of it, appear to be one of the best jobs in the county. But spend a shift with the people who monitor the waterways, and it is clear it is not all plain sailing. Will Mason and Bob Goddard are two members of the Broads Authority's team of rangers, who are responsible for keeping people safe while on the water, among countless other duties. Their main beat last summer was Breydon Water and the connecting rivers, the Yare, Waveney and Lower Bure. While many days are spent gliding along rivers on patrol, within a split second their day can switch from idyllic to high stakes, where they can sometimes be the first people to arrive at serious incidents. As Mr. Mason puts it, there are two key rules every ranger must follow. Be ready to change your plans and don't forget your lunch. The pair see themselves as custodians of the rivers, and they must be ready to undertake a huge range of duties, from spot checks of boats to check for hazards to help direct the thousands of tourists that visit each summer. There seems to be no end to the work they may have to do. Mr. Mason, who has worked in the role for 3 years as a seasonal ranger, said, "It is a mixture of enforcement, conservation and maintenance. We do not know what we will find each day." Full-time ranger roles are in huge demand in the Broads, and to have a chance of getting the job, people often have to gain experience first through volunteering. Mr. Goddard first started off as key staff before taking on a full-time Broads ranger role 4 years ago. He said, "When the tourist season ends, the work changes drastically, and we do a lot more conservation work, such as reptile surveys and maintenance. It is hard graft, but I love it. But there's also a social care element, with rangers having a responsibility to monitor the well-being of people who live on the Broads in boats. One rewarding part of the job is speaking to people and building rapport," Mr. Goddard added. "Some people have issues going on in their life, such as substance abuse. It's a difficult life for some people living on boats, particularly in the winter. It is their home, so you have to be respectful. Some people can be challenging. But at the same time, people modify their vessels, such as installing gas systems and stoves, which can pose a serious health and safety risk. People not paying their tolls and using boats that fail to meet safety standards are becoming growing issues for the rangers to monitor. Enforcing the Broads Authority's rules can lead to clashes with boaters. In recent years, they have seen a rise in antisocial behaviour, sparking calls for body cams to be used. Mr. Goddard acknowledges some interactions can be challenging, but says on the most part people are respectful. Off the water, the Broads Authority also employs a number of seasonal key rangers, who have an equally important role in keeping people safe getting on and off the boats. Duncan Moore and David Jones, between them, have nearly 30 years' experience working at Great Yarmouth Yacht Station. This is one of the most dangerous stretches of river in the Broads, where strong tides pose a real risk if people fall into the water. In 2024, this danger was realised after a man from Skegness fell from a boat and died. The team at Yarmouth have to constantly monitor whether people are wearing life jackets and keep holidaymakers safe when they moor. Recent messages about the dangers of not wearing flotation devices appears to be working, and there have not been any major incidents at Yarmouth this year, Broads bosses have said. Back on the water, Mr. Goddard and Mr. Mason are adamant that being a Broads Ranger is one of the best jobs around, despite the challenges. Mr. Goddard said, "You get to spend the summer on board a boat, helping people and watching wildlife. It's a privilege to do this job.
A charity which supports thousands of Norfolk people with disabilities has warned of a funding cliff edge after seeing a huge drop-off in income. Bosses at the Build charity have appealed for help so that the charity, which saw its income cut by £30,000 last year, can keep providing crucial social, leisure and learning opportunities for adults with disabilities. Demand for services from the charity, which was founded in 1967 and is based in Bank Street, Norwich, is increasing, but income dropped by 41%. It has been hit hard by national changes in charitable trust funding and the restructuring or closure of organisations which traditionally give grants. The charity is urging local people, businesses and funders to help protect the lifeline which community-based charities provide to people in need. It's calling on individuals to give what they can through singular or regular donations and on businesses to explore long-term partnerships with smaller charities, staff fundraising challenges, skill-sharing schemes and sponsorship of specific activities. James Cairns, the chief executive of the Build charity, said, "Many charities locally and nationally, including us here at Build, have seen and expect to continue to see a squeeze on funding from local and national charitable trusts. The view held across the sector is that competition between those seeking funding to meet an increased demand for services and rising employment and infrastructure costs has dramatically increased, with some funders seeing a 30 to 50% increase in application, while some have seen applications double. In a very challenging funding environment, we've worked hard to reduce our costs, increase membership and grow our volunteer base. That means anyone with any disability aged 18 or over in Norfolk has the opportunity to enjoy the kind of social life most of us take for granted. But our core costs are already cut to the bone and we're now dipping into our reserves just to manage cash flow. Without new investment from our Norfolk community, we risk having to reduce services at the very moment people need them the most." The charity delivered 279 activities between April 2024 and March 2025, involving 2,633 people. And it comes at a time when most voluntary services are facing the crunch amid dwindling funds.
David Cowley has every reason to celebrate the start of 2026. As the new year begins, Mr. Cowley is enjoying his amazing new slimline look and is excited for the future after completing an astonishing weight loss journey. Mr. Cowley, aged 72, the former owner of a galvanising metals company in Great Yarmouth, weighed more than 25 stone when he first joined the Scrappy Slimming World group in May 2024. He joined the group after his doctor told him he needed to lose weight following the diagnosis of a heart condition which put his health at risk. It has led to him shedding 10 stone. Mr. Cowley said, "I was vastly overweight, struggling with health issues. I retired 4 or 5 years ago and I was just sitting about doing nothing. I was gradually going downhill and I thought it was time to make a life-changing decision." Guided by his consultant and supported by the group, Mr. Cowley now weighs the lightest he has weighed in 25 years. The health changes have completely transformed his life for the better. He said, "I couldn't walk anywhere that far before. Now I can swim and cycle. It has changed my life entirely. I've played in bands all my life, and the last 4 years I've had to sit down. I'm back standing up again now." He was initially dubious about joining the group, but was reassured to find many men attending it. The super slimmer said, "You get the perception that it is only ladies there. There are men going there, and you probably feel a bit strange at first, but you get welcomed so quickly. If you're a man, you can do it." Dina Ball, local Slimming World consultant, said Mr. Cowley's courage and commitment inspire the whole 8am group, and she was so proud of him and everything he had achieved.
Well done on that, David, but you probably don't want to listen to this next article then, because the highest rated fish and chips in Norfolk have been revealed. TripAdvisor has compiled a list of the best places to get the British staple in towns and villages across the county. Among the top spots were the King's Arms in Flegborough and the Wells Crab House Seafood Restaurant. But the best place in Norfolk was revealed to be the White Swan Fish and Seafood in Great Yarmouth. The family-owned restaurant is situated just off the North Quay, and it took top spot with a rating of 4.7 out of 5 on the review website. The restaurant offers a wide range of fish and seafood, prepared and cooked daily with ingredients sourced from local fishmongers. Its classic fish and chips dish is served with garden or mushy peas and tartar sauce. And a fish and chip night also takes place on Wednesdays, and customers have a choice of cod, haddock, plaice or skate. Other popular dishes also include the Chippies garlic king prawns and lobster. The restaurant prides itself on its traditional smoking methods that the chefs use to add a distinct flavour to the fish. One reviewer on TripAdvisor said, "What a superb little restaurant. This was our second visit and both the food and the service were outstanding." And another reviewer added, "A fabulous meal from start to finish. The meal was divine. The fish was just melt in your mouth and so soft and tender." Ooh, blimey, that's making me peckish.
In 1901, Herbert Bennett was hanged for the gruesome murder of his wife Mary on Great Yarmouth Seafront. And now, 124 years after Bennett's execution at Norwich Jail, his great-grandson is trying to prove his ancestors' innocence. Paul Fitchett, aged 72, is convinced that Mary was not murdered by her husband. Mr. Fitchett is trying to build a new argument to take to the courts, as he believes vital pieces of evidence were missed in the original six-week-long trial. He believes someone else was responsible for the death of Mary, who was found dead on Great Yarmouth Beach in 1900. She was strangled by a shoelace when staying in the town with her young daughter, Ruby. That's Paul's grandmother. The pair were originally from London, which is where Mr. Fitchett also calls home. Evidence at the time led courts to believe that Mary's estranged husband was responsible for her death, and he was convicted at the Old Bailey in London, but hanged in Norwich. Mr. Fitchett has been researching the case for around 20 years and is adamant that Bennett was innocent in this tragedy. He said, "The more I researched it, the more I couldn't understand why he would kill his wife. I think he was wrongly hanged." He was involved in an episode of the BBC documentary Murder, Mystery and My Family surrounding the case in 2018, which spurred his interest further. Mr. Fitchett added, "The driving force behind my interest in this is that I want him to be proved innocent, because I'm completely convinced in the fact that he's not guilty. I would love him to be buried somewhere else. Bennett is buried on prison grounds. Mary is buried in the main cemetery in Yarmouth."
An amber weather warning has been issued for snow and ice in Norfolk. The Met Office has issued the warning for between 12 a.m. on Saturday, January the 3rd, and 11:59 p.m. on Saturday, January the 3rd. There is expected to be frequent heavy snow showers moving in from the coast, which may bring disruption to travel on Saturday. Some roads and railways will likely be affected, with longer journey times by road, bus and train. Also, people may be injured from slips and falls on icy surfaces, and there will probably be some icy patches on some untreated roads, pavements and cycle paths. It is advised to expect delays, as driving conditions will be dangerous, so keep yourself and others safe by planning your route and giving yourself extra time for your journey. Also check for road closures or delays to public transport and amend plans if necessary. The Amber Alert will last until 10 a.m. on Tuesday. There is also expected to be a rise in demand for health services, particularly among the over 65s and those with health conditions.
A seal pup was rescued after it got wedged tightly between rocks. The large pup, weighing around 40 kilos, was found trapped at Waxham on Tuesday. A family saw the seal in distress and called Friends of Horsey Seals to help free it from the rocks. Sally Butler, chairman of the charity, said, "The pup was well and truly trapped and may have drowned when the tide came in, as it certainly wouldn't have got out on its own. It took a considerable amount of effort due to its size and predicament. Very thankfully we had help to pull it out, as the pup was huge and around 40 kilos. It is not known how long the seal was stuck for, but Warden said the pup is now safe and recovering from the incident. Another pup was found trapped between rocks in Waxham the day after. Friends of Horsey Seals were again called out to rescue the second seal, which has been safely released back onto the beach."
Police are searching for a man who is wanted on recall to prison. Alan Hetherington, 37, from Great Yarmouth and Goulston area, is wanted after breaching the terms of his licence. He's also known to frequent Norwich. He is described as white, of slim to medium build, around 5 feet 8 inches tall, with light brown hair. Anyone who has seen him or knows of his whereabouts is urged to contact Norfolk Constabulary by calling 101.
Well, that's all the news for this week. So, welcome to Grapevine Extra. Although it has to be said, we do actually have one item of news left, which we must celebrate. So, firstly, over to Alison for the details.
And here's some good news about someone with whom listeners are well acquainted. This has been the biggest surprise of my life. These are the words of 92-year-old Malcolm Metcalfe after finding out he was recognised in the King's New Year's Honours List. Mr Metcalfe, from Galston, has been awarded a British Empire Medal, or BEM, for his fundraising for charities. He received the letter towards the end of November, but was sworn to secrecy until it was officially announced. He said, "I've had a lot of surprises in my life, but this is the biggest one. I am just overwhelmed. I keep reading the letter over and over again. I wish my mother and father, twin brother and sister, were all here to see it." Mr Metcalfe, nicknamed the Michael Palin of Galston because of his travels around the globe, has been raising money for hospices for years. He caught the travelling bug when he was 19 and was bedbound with TB of the spine for more than a year. His brother Trevor gave him a world travel book, which he read every day, and vowed that he would travel when he got better, using his journeys to raise money for the East Coast Hospice. And from his travels to Australia with only £250, to going the length and breadth of England in 1 month on his bus pass when he was 82, his passion for adventure has never faltered. One of Mr Metcalfe's most recent fundraisers saw him set himself a target to raise £10,000 for the Priscilla Bacon Lodge in Norwich by completing 90 challenges before his 90th birthday. His challenges included flying a plane, taking a ride in a Formula One car, and editing the EDP, the Eastern Daily Press. His popular mission even led to Mr Metcalfe meeting the King during a visit to Priscilla Bacon Lodge, where he presented the King with his book called My Adventurous Life.
Yes, as Alison said there, Malcolm is well known to us. As you may recall, he's appeared on Grapevine several times, and he's always a joy. He's always a joy to speak to. Now, I have here a copy of his book, My Adventurous Life, and I'm pleased to say he signed it for me as well. And in there, there's a foreword by Tony Mallion, renowned local journalist and broadcaster and fellow Galston man, as Malcolm is. The book was written in 2014, and it appears in the book just before this Malcolm section called Riding the Iron Horse, where Malcolm tells of his journeys across the USA on the famous Amtrak trains. I hope this will give you a bit of an insight into the man, and it's a tribute, I think, to his adventurous spirit. Here's your starter for 10. What's the connection between the Queen's Christmas message of 2013 and a young man from Galston? Time's up. Introducing the theme of reflection in her annual speech, Her Majesty said, "I once knew someone who spent a year in a plaster cast recovering from an operation on his back. He read a lot and thought a lot and felt miserable. Later he realised this time of forced retreat from the world had helped him to understand the world more clearly." Now, the Queen was actually talking about Sir Alec Douglas Hume, later to become Prime Minister and a greatly respected Foreign Secretary. But her words could just have easily referred to Malcolm Metcalfe, who, at the age of 20 in 1953, was similarly subjected to a year in plaster and bed after a serious spinal operation. Malcolm could have given in to defeat and depression, but he didn't. Instead, it led ultimately to a determination to see the world, fueled by a travel book provided during his enforced immobilisation by his twin brother Trevor. In an era when a week's bed and breakfast in Skegness would have seemed a big adventure, Malcolm set his sights on Singapore, the Far East and Australia. And not long afterwards, this seemingly ordinary young man from the Magnum Estate in Goulston followed his extraordinary dreams and set off to explore, not with a package tour operator, but hitchhiking and trusting in a bit of luck and occasional hard work to see him through to the other side of the world. He did it, and those stories were recorded in his first memoir, Malcolm's Luck. But, of course, that wasn't enough. As a youngster, he'd met up with American GIs during the war, one of whom had given him a vase, which he treasures to this day. And that later led to travels across the states, this time using the Amtrak rail network, and not to mention his network of friends and contacts, and, of course, for Malcolm, more lucky encounters. If ever the time-honoured phrase carpe diem, or seize the day, was true, Malcolm demonstrates it time and time again. To date, and he has made his latest trip in the autumn of 2013, he has notched up over 200,000 miles crisscrossing the states and also taking a short foray into Canada. So this is the second volume from this globetrotter. Malcolm's not just a keen traveller, but a well-informed naturalist, so his tales bring us plenty of observations of nature, including rather close encounters with dangerous snakes. It's a combination of Michael Palin with David Attenborough. Fascinating too is his excursion by horse-drawn cart into the closed world of an Amish community in Canada. The way that only Malcolm could end up joining a top band travelling the states in style on their luxury tour bus, and experience rushing to an emergency when he landed a lift in a police patrol car late one night, even if it did lead him being accused momentarily of being an arsonist. As a fellow Goulston boy, I seem to have always been aware of Malcolm, not least because for a time he worked for the builders merchant Precasters, as did my father. But in later years as a broadcaster with BBC Radio Norfolk, I was grateful for the fact that he was willing to share his stories and adventures with audiences on the programmes I presented. He's always generously given illustrated talks to groups and organisations about his travels, and it's good that he's taken time to put his well-organised memories permanently in book form. And who knows, it might inspire others to follow his lead. Well, Tony, they're very true words, and from all of us here at Grapevine, if you're listening to this, Malcolm, absolute congratulations on your medal. It's thoroughly, thoroughly deserved.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come fly with me, let's take off in the blue. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll just fly starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you so near, you may hear angels cheer, 'cause we're together. Weather-wise, it's such a lovely day. Just say the words and we'll beat the birds down to Acapulco Bay. It's perfect for a flying honeymoon, they say. Come fly with me, let's fly away. once I get you up there where the air is rarefied, we'll just glide starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you so near. You may hear angels cheer, 'cause we're together weather-wise. It's such a lovely day. You just say the words and we'll beat the birds down to Acapulco Bay. It's perfect for a flying honeymoon, they say. Come fly with me, let's fly, let's fly. Pack up, let's fly away.
Yes, many congratulations to Malcolm for his New Year's honour. On the theme of which, New Year that is, here's Alison again.
The New Year dawned yesterday, and no doubt many listeners saw it in one way or another. I wondered how long people have been celebrating New Year, and how celebrations have changed over the years. It's only since 1752 that the 1st of January has been New Year's Day at all. From the 12th century, the 25th of March had been seen as New Year's Day, but this was eventually changed back when the Gregorian calendar was adopted instead of the Julian calendar, and it became necessary to align with the rest of Europe and avoid confusion with dates. The tradition of celebrating a new year goes back thousands of years. Some of the customs result from the idea of looking forward, but also looking back at the past year. Indeed, the name of the first month of the year, January, comes from the Roman god Janus, who had two faces, one looking forward and the other looking back. This is reflected in the names given to 31st of December. Is it Old Year's Night, looking back, or New Year's Eve, looking forward? For most of us, it's a matter of family tradition. The idea of making a New Year resolution is a very old custom. It's thought that the Babylonians may have started making New Year resolutions as long as 4,000 years ago, in order to please their gods. Some people mark midnight on New Year's Eve with first footing, which means that the first guest to cross the threshold of the house, or first foot, may bring good luck, if of course they're the right type of person. In Great Yarmouth, a man or boy would visit the house soon after midnight, carrying a herring, a piece of coal, and some bread, to symbolise prosperity in the coming year. Many people sing Auld Lang Syne at New Year. This was a poem written by the Scottish poet Robert Burns in 1788, and it literally means old long since. The lyrics are about old friends having a drink and reminiscing about the past, but there is no direct reference to New Year. The words were put to music, and they became part of the Hogmanay celebrations in Scotland during the 19th century. An event known as Plough Monday is still celebrated in some villages soon after New Year. This is an old tradition that marks the start of the agricultural season, and it takes place on the first Monday after Epiphany, which is January the 6th, so it will be on the 12th of January this year. In the past, people would sing and dance through villages, pulling a plough. The aim was to raise money, but if you didn't give anything, the chances were that your garden would be ploughed up. To avoid being recognised, participants would blacken their face with soil. The tradition has died out almost everywhere, but it still takes place in some East Anglian villages. There are also some old superstitions linked to New Year. Some people will keep a new calendar with its face to the wall until after midnight has chimed on the 31st of December. Other people thought that any rubbish should be thrown out and all dirty clothes and bed linen washed on the 31st of December. Others open the back door at midnight to see the old year out and then open the front door to let the new year in. Whatever you did to see in 2026, we wish you a happy new year.
There's some interesting ones there, Alison. I didn't know the herring and the coal in Yarmouth.
I should think it was quite a long time ago.
Yeah, I would imagine it would. See, we always try to keep you entertained and informed here on Grapevine. And in that vein, we have a special guest in the studio today. Joining us today is Edward Bates, Alison's son. And many of you probably know Edward from Vision Norfolk. Eldred, welcome.
Yes, Happy New Year, everybody. Nice to be here. Nice to actually see how it's recorded. It's a long while since I've been in the studio watching Grapevine being done, so it's nice to see it being recorded.
Don't tell everybody about it, though, will you? How it's done, please.
Of course
not. Don't give away any secrets.
All trade secrets. secrets, absolutely.
Edward, how was last year for Vision Norfolk?
Yeah, last year was decent. You know, we had new activities. We had some more people coming in, and it was good across the board, you know, because we've got three offices, Norwich, King's Lynn and Great Yarmouth. So all in all, it was pretty decent, but it's getting out there and it's getting to people, and we need more of that as we head into 2026. Last year was a particularly important year for us because it was our 220th anniversary, and that's going to carry on actually somewhat as well into the new year, because we were technically founded in October 1805, so technically you could say that the celebration will go on to October this year. But it's making sure that we carry on with that and making sure that we get out there to those people who need our support.
I always find that amazing that the organisation is 200 plus years old.
It's fantastic.
To really think that somebody was clever enough to found an organisation to assist visually impaired people all those years ago.
Well, exactly. And of course, the support now that people require is very different. Back in the day, a lot of the people who they supported in the 1805 and the early years were destitute. They were homeless, living on the street. Now that we've got, you know, the way that the world is for people with disabilities and the way that, you know, people live on their own, there's more technology available now. People can do more for themselves. And it's making sure that we move in the right times and in the right ways to ensure that we are promoting that independence, if you like.
And you'd obviously encourage our listeners to come along and see you.
Of course. If people have any problems with their vision, they want some support, we can help with that kind of thing, social support or a bit of support in the home. We've got an outreach worker who can come in and help with things like completing blue badge application forms. They can help with certain benefits as well, like attendance allowance or PIP forms. But people can also drop into the office to have a look at bits of equipment as well. And as I say, join in with some of the activities. We're looking to carry on with our regular activities, which we do send in. And I know Graham often reads these out at the start of the month. So thank you to Graham for that. We're looking to develop a few more.
And your office is situated on
Hawkey.
Hawkey, that's yeah. Right, yeah. And you're open from?
We're open 9 till 5, Monday to Friday. I think the big problem that we have is getting people through that door. I think there's a lot of people who think, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, that we are a medical place, but we might tell people that their sight is going to either get worse or go. Well, as I'm behind the microphone now, I'll simply say to you that is just simply what we don't do. We're not medical professionals. You know, that's the job of the hospitals to tell you about your sight condition. We can't possibly make comments about that. If I'm in that sort of situation, I've been known to say to people, look, occasionally this could happen. It could get worse, but it might not. We're not here to talk about that, but we're here to talk about things that may make your life slightly easier and may make it slightly more accessible for you to do things that you think you might not be able to do. We can possibly help with that, and hopefully we make a big difference in that.
That's great to know, and that hopefully that might have cleared things up for a few people. So to know that they're more than welcome to drop in and see you to talk about aspects of their life, things that they need help with.
Absolutely. You know, if anyone has a sight loss, you don't have to be registered either with a doctor. If you notice a change in your vision, I mean, because hospital appointments can take time to be organised, but if you notice any kind of change in your vision, and you think, I wonder if something can help me, you know, help me with it, certainly come and see us. We can show you bits and pieces of equipment as to what may help you. We cannot talk about the long-term prognosis for any sight loss conditions.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Ed. Now, aside from Vision Norfolk, you yourself are well known for your challenges. We know Snowden. We know the toughest one was the sponsored silence.
Oh, never again. Never again.
So anything on the agenda for this year?
Honestly, not this year. Not this year. I mean, I have to say, the support I got for the last two challenges from people giving me money, for Vision Norfolk, I should point out, the support I got from that was absolutely incredible. I think you've got to be careful what you kind of go for. You don't want to give people fatigue, if you like. So at the moment, there's nothing planned.
No.
But I kind of think I fancy a year off it this year. But when I say that now, and probably something will crop up. So I wouldn't like to sit here and say definitely no. But the challenge has got to be a sensible one. I've done a lot of the sporting physical ones. And so the silence was a very different one.
I do know you're still in training, though. I do know you're still regularly, you know, visiting the gym. So
yeah,
there's obviously something going up. But on a again, another personal note, I also know that you're studying hard playing the church organ now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, that's something that I've always kind of been interested in doing. And I didn't really think it would be possible until we went to an event about a year and a half ago for work, actually. It was at the St. Peter's Church in Galston. And I met the organist there, Matthew Hardy, who came up and asked me about the stall. And I told him about Vision Norfolk. And I said, oh, you know, that was great organ playing. I'm considering getting involved. And before I barely finished the sentence, I was on this tour across the church going back in to have a look at the organ. Of course, I saw this massive complex in front of me, and I said, well, there's no way I can play this. He said, well, you can if you play piano, because I used to play piano in the past. And a few things happened, and before I knew it, last year I started having lessons with somebody in Norwich. I then went on a course so that I could actually pick up my skills a bit more quickly, because it's hard when you're at work. And now I go and practice in my local church a couple of times a week, and I did my first service on Christmas Eve. That was scary. Have to say that was scary. But
it went well?
Yeah, the church was full. Not because they were coming to watch me. They all wanted their Chris Singles, of course, because it was that time. But I think it went well, and the people were very nice about it. And hopefully now that's something else that I can start developing in the new year.
Well, that's another amazing skill. Is there a big difference between that and piano?
Yes. Yeah, there is, because you've got two keyboards most of the time, but some organs have three. I saw one last year in London that had four keyboards to it. I didn't play four all at once. But you've also got the fun of putting in the pedals for the bass accompaniment.
Oh, of course, yes.
So on the piano, you only have two, possibly three pedals, depending on what kind of piano you've got. But the pedals are a full sort of 2.5 octaves. Maybe on the organ I practice, 2.5 octaves, but it could be more, it could be less, depending on what you practice on. And so, it's remembering to move your feet at the right time and not, you know, because it's very easy to misjudge where you are on the board. And yeah, but the pedals are not as scary as I thought they might be. But it's just thinking, you know, I'm a man. I don't multitask. So I've
had... You got a really rueful look from your mum then when you said that. And... obviously, it's classical music, yeah?
Yeah, yes, it is. It's classical music and it's church music. As somebody who hasn't been to church for years, it's quite astonishing, really, that I'm doing this. But I really enjoy hearing it, and I find it quite good when people sing along. It must be doing something right if people join in.
Are you ever tempted to go the full Rick Wakeman, though?
There's still time.
Edward, lovely to speak to you. Thanks very
Thanks
much
for, having
for
me
coming
on.
In, and Happy New Year to you.
And to you and all the listeners.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Well, that's it for this week. Grapevine is copyright 2026 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. Next week, your newsreaders will be Desney and Margaret. So, we look forward to your company for that. But in the meantime, we wish you a good week and hope that you stay safe and well, albeit possibly snowed in. So from everyone here at Grapevine, it's bye for now. And once again, our wishes for a very happy and healthy new year.